Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth, the rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Roaring Truth with myself and my excellent co-host, Jim Fetzer. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, Marie. Great to be with you. My God, so many things are happening in the world. It's unreal.
I know.
Most of them right here in the USA, but others in the Middle East. So.
Oh, the Middle East looks like it's really heating up. I don't know if you saw the report where the Pentagon had to admit they lied about how many troops we had in Syria.
Well, that would come as no surprise, but I'm fascinated that they're taking out the opium laboratories in Afghanistan. This appears to be cutting off the CIA, Maria. It's absolutely most welcome development. It suggests to me, along with rumors that Marines have taken control of Langley, that Donald may actually be draining the swamp.
Well, I don't know about that. Let's not get too carried away too soon. Jim, I am fortunate to have you on this quick right after the JFK conference and after all this paper dump that was released. So I'm dying to ask you, what's going on and what's the latest? What are the new findings?
Well, it's all really quite fascinating, Maria. Any of our listeners may want to visit my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. In particular, if they go there and just enter JFK, they'll get the blog, JFK Bethesda Autopsy Photos, Not JFK, Oswald Framed, Warren Report a Sham, which I presented during the conference this weekend before last. It was the 17th, 18th, and 19th, because the 22nd, the observance would be in midweek. And I presented a proof that the autopsy photographs, which we have presumed to be authentic, in fact, are not of the body of JFK, that we have additional proof that confirms that Lee Oswald was indeed standing in the doorway of the book depository as the motorcade passed by, and therefore, as we had long since inferred, but which we have now, you know, really been able to establish beyond any semblance of doubt, cannot have been the lone demented gunman or even one of the shooters, which is the deepest, darkest secret the Warren Commission sought to keep from the public. And in addition, we have been able to identify the identity of the individual stood in for Lee Oswald in the backyard photographs, one of which was published on the cover of Life magazine to convict him in the minds of the public. Lee had told Will Fritz, the homicide detective interrogating him, when shown one of these photographs, that it was his face pasted on someone else's body. He knew something about photography, and with time he'd be able to prove it. Well, Lee was exactly right. He didn't live, of course, long enough to do it, but Jim Mars and I co-authored an article entitled Framing the Patsy, the Case of Lee Harvey Oswald, in which we took apart the photograph. We observed, among other points, that the chin is not Oswald's more tapered chin, but a block chin, that there's an insert line between the chin and the lower lip, that the fingertips of the right hand are cut off, holding these communist newspapers, the worker and the militant. Of course, he's holding the Mannlicher Carcano, one of three different weapons, may I say, that have been identified as the assassination weapon, and a rifle belt with the revolver he owned, with which he's alleged to have shot J.D. Tippit, but it turns out that the first officer on the scene recovered four shell casings that had been ejected from automatics, which he initialed. They were two different manufacturers. Remington, Rand, and Western, where a woman across the street, Aquila Clemens, had 2 men had shot Tippit, and neither of them looked like Oswald. Who was actually at the Texas Theater already buying popcorn, Maria, when the shooting took place. When they discovered they bungled the shell casings at the scene, they made a substitution. The Dallas police felt very much at liberty to do this, since they appear to have been assigned the role of framing Oswald and did it in a clumsy fashion. With 4 revolver shell casings now, none of which have the initials of the officer, and now we have 3 of one make and 1 of the other, we've been able to, Jim Mars and I had concluded, because of the height, the weight, the build, and the block chin, but also because of an odd anomaly on the right wrist, which appears to have been from an improperly healed bone, that it had been Roscoe White, who was a Dallas police officer tied to the CIA, who'd stood in for Lee. Well, Larry Rivera discovered the perfect photograph of Roscoe to superimpose, and indeed we have confirmed that it was Roscoe White in the doorway. So when you put this together, Maria, there's really virtually nothing left of the Warren Commission report. It's not that the body that underwent examination was not that of JFK, but that the autopsy photographs that have been released are not those of JFK. And indeed, it was done by the same fellow, Robert Groden, who would release the extant version of the Zapruder film to Geraldo Rivera on his show in 1975, where endless effort has been expended by students of JFK analyzing the frames of the film to determine when different shots were fired, which is, of course, not completely meaningless, but it's chasing your tail when you, once you realize that it's, the film's been massively edited and revised. Similarly, you couldn't, you know, conduct any proper analysis of the body using photographs or of someone else's body. This is a very interesting confirmation, by the way, of a conversation that Jackie and Bobby had at the time of the formal laying in state of the body in the nation's capital on the 24th. Of November 1963, they had to decide whether to have an open or a closed casket, and they both agreed that it didn't look like Jack, and therefore they had a closed casket. And we now know the reason it didn't look like Jack was because it wasn't Jack.
Well, but what do you think happened to the original president, the original body?
Well, I suspect that they, you know, disposed of it, that it was just too dangerous to have it around, because if you had the real body, you could go back and reconstruct at least some of the shots. We did know from the mortician, Thomas Evan Robinson, who spent more time with the body than anyone else, that he had a shot between, 5 and 6 inches below the shoulder on the back, which was the first shot that hit JFK, fired from the top of the county records building by a Dallas deputy sheriff, that he had, a small wound in the right temple with a fist-sized blowout at the back of the head. Also that he had 2 tiny puncture wounds in his face, which David Mantic, MD, PhD, who's the leading expert on the medical evidence, brilliantly inferred were caused by tiny shards of glass. When the bullet that hit Jack in the throat passing through the windshield released those tiny shards, which revealed themselves when embalming was taking place. He had to pack them with wax to stop the bleeding. A bullet that appears to have been fired from inside the triple underpass by an Air Force expert who'd gone to work for the automobile dealership that provided the vehicles for the motorcade, which, unlike any other presidential motorcade in history, were all different makes, models, and colors so that the perps would know exactly where everyone was. They even moved JFK's military aide, who would normally have sat in the front seat in between Roy Kellerman, the agent in charge, in the passenger seat, and William Greer, the driver, but they moved him to the back, the furthest vehicle in the motorcade, along with the president's personal physician, Admiral George Berkeley, because otherwise the bullet that intended for JFK would have hit the military aide instead. So all of this was very thoroughly thought out. The shot that entered the right temple, by the way, that blew out the back of his head, was fired from the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the picket fence by a soldier of fortune with ties to both the CIA and the mafia, where Jack had a second hit to the back of the head, which the Bethesda physicians acknowledged, that had been fired from the Dal Tex by an anti-Castro Cuban who was, in fact, astonishingly enough, under the supervision of George Herbert Walker Bush, who would be arrested coming out of the Dal Tex, Maria, identifying himself as an independent Houston oilman, which was a CIA cover, where the Dallas deputy sheriff kept a record of the arrest, so that, you know, we know what happened here. He would be questioned and later released and wind up standing in front of the book depository where I discovered it, his image in a photograph in Jesse Curry's JFK assassination file, a collection of photographs the former chief of police of Dallas published when he was head of security for 7-Eleven stores that was only available in paperbacks at 7-Eleven. So we have three key photographs related to those who set up the actual shooting. We have not only Bush in front of the book depository, but we have Edward Lansdale, an Air Force general responsible for assassinations around the world, especially in Vietnam, walking past the three tramps, identified by no less authorities than L. Fletcher Prouty and Victor Krulak, among the most celebrated of all Marine Corps generals. And then a third photograph of Lansdale waiting to speak to Bush, where many of us are convinced that Lansdale positioned the shooters and determined the sequence in which the shots would be taken.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this, because I'm sure you've gone over the released papers. Did they release any new photographs too, or was it just all print?
Well, that's a really good question. And I have not gone through them all, but I can tell you of some significant developments. Here's a rather striking one, which is that among the earliest documents released was one showing that the mayor of Dallas at the time, Earl Campbell, whom I had long since concluded was the Dallas axis of the connection between the CIA, because his brother Charles was an Air Force lieutenant general fired by JFK, along with the other deputy director of the CIA, Richard Bissell, in the wake of his reinvestigation of what had actually happened, how he'd been subjected to a bait and switch by Maxwell Taylor and Bobby. And it turns out that Earl, the brother, who was born near Dallas in 1906, while Charles, his older brother, was born in Dallas in 1903, so this was their backyard, actually joined the CIA in 1956. So we have a document showing that Earl Campbell joined the CIA in 1956. Now, it's interesting that Newsweek has published an article that the JFK assassination conspiracy theories might worsen with new records of the president's death, which is confirmed by the following release that on September 16th, 1965, KGB residency in New York received instructions from KGB headquarters in Moscow to develop all possible information concerning President Lyndon B. Johnson's character, background, personal friends, family, from which quarters he derives his support and his position as President of the United States, because now the KGB was in possession of data purporting to indicate President Johnson was responsible for the assassination of the late President John F. Kennedy. And of course, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have a mass of evidence about it. I've reported on this many times. I had over 100 conversations with Madeline Duncan Brown, who was a mistress of Lyndon. They began an affair in 48. She bore him a child, a son, Stephen, in 1950. She attended the ratification meeting at the home of Clint Murchison the night before, where Richard Nixon was president. She remembered he was driven out by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank building where she was a young advertising executive. J. Edgar Hoover was there. She thought it might have been an event in his honor because he would stop and stay at the Murchison home on way to Del Mar Racetrack in California with his close personal friend, Clyde Tolson. When Hoover went to the track, his bets invariably won. It turned out Murchison owned the racetrack. John J. McCloy was there, former high commissioner to Germany, former head of Chase Manhattan. Chase Manhattan Bank, representing the Eastern Banking Establishment. George Brown, Brown and Root Heavy Construction was there. That Brown and Root would receive $1 billion when the Vietnam War went down to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, even though Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports, and I'm quite sure they didn't need another. Mm-hmm. When Lyndon showed up late in the evening unexpectedly to the others, and there were only about 36 people at this rather exclusive event, the heavy hitters disappeared into a boardroom for 15 or 20 minutes. When they broke up, Lyndon strode over to Madeline, who told me she expected him to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. That's not a threat. That's a promise. The following day, he actually called her and repeated the same message. They would have a rendezvous on New Year's Eve, 6 weeks later, at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, during which Madeline confronted Lyndon with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. Right. He blew up at her and told her the CIA and the Olin boys had decided Jack had to be taken out. But Maria, we know Lyndon was deeply involved in this from the beginning. He forced himself on the ticket in Los Angeles in 1960. Mm-hmm. He wasn't on Jack or Bobby's long list, much less their short. But Jack had already invited Stuart Symington of Missouri to be his running mate, but gave him overnight to think about it. When Bobby went by the Johnson suite to extend a pro forma offer, he was astonished that Lyndon leaped on it, threatened to expose that Jack had Addison's disease, wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, that he'd had dalliances with beautiful women, some of whom were spies for East Germany, both of which were true, but also added that if he were not on the ticket, then he would bottle up any legislative proposal sent down from the White House and would be dead on arrival in his position as the powerful majority leader. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way around, but they were boxed in by Lyndon and had to accept him as Jack's running mate. When one of Lyndon's wealthy backers learned of this, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing, because now LBJ was going to help JFK become president. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan. Bobby Baker would later declare that Jack would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. As it played out, Lyndon would send his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination.
Crazy. So what did you think about all the redacted stuff, especially about the CIA in the release that they did put out?
Well, you know, the whole situation is completely absurd in the following respect. If the official story were true, if Lee Oswald had been a lone, disgruntled Marine who got off three lucky shots and happened to hit Jack in the back, then Connolly in the back, then Jack in the back of the head, killing him, which was the conclusion of the Secret Service and the FBI the very day of the shooting, there was no national security aspect to the case. So bottling up documents on the grounds of national security was always a manifest absurdity and an implicit contradiction from the story we were being given by the Warren Commission. In fact, they initially secured all of their documents and records for 75 years, apparently, on the ground that the average lifespan of an American is 75 years. So they wanted no one who'd been alive at the time to be alive when the documents were released. This would be preempted by the resurgence of interest generated by Oliver Stone's film JFK, released in 1991. Mm-hmm. So that in 1992, Congress passed the JFK Records Act that created a 5-person civilian board with the authority to declassify documents and records from the CIA, the Secret Service, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and so forth, where only the president could override their decisions. It had a 25-year lifespan. So you put 25 years together with 2012 and you wind up with 1992, 25 years plus 1992 equals 2017, which is why these releases are happening now. Trump, I heard mixed reports, Maria. You may be able to correct me, that he actually was overriding the final appeals from the agencies that did not want these documents to be declassified. But I'll tell you, there's some other good stuff in there. Judith Vary Baker has been particularly gratified to find their confirmations of Lee's possession of this Minox camera that is used in spy work, a highly technical mini camera that confirmed the story she's been telling about him based on her relationship with Lee during the summer before the assassination, when they were together in New Orleans and working with David Ferry under the supervision of Dr. Mary Sherman to develop a rapid-acting cancer to be used as a bioweapon. They used to joke about their names, because she was at the time Judith Vary, about Mary Ferry and Vary. But her book, Me and Lee, is just chock full of observations that humanize Lee Oswald, make it clear that he actually was living out his lifetime dream. His favorite show as a young man had been I Led Three Lives with Herb Philbrick, and Lee turned out to have been recruited by the Office of Naval Intelligence when he was undergoing training at the recruit depot in San Diego. He was stationed at our most secure base in Atsugi, Japan, the source of the U-2 overflights. He did a pseudo-defection to the Soviet Union at the request of the CIA to provide them information about the altitude of the flights. On the eve of a summit between Khrushchev and Eisenhower that was widely expected to reduce Cold War tensions, Khrushchev accused Eisenhower, the United States, of spying on the Soviet Union. Eisenhower denied that Khrushchev produced the pilot, Gary Francis Power, who had not taken his cyanide tablet, parts of the U-2 they'd shot down. It was very embarrassing, led to abandoning the summit and increasing Cold War tensions rather than reducing them. Lee, meanwhile, would marry the niece of a KGB colonel, return to the United States, not be treated as a traitor, met by a CIA front organization, giving money to relocate. He wound up in New Orleans, Marina in Dallas, at the home of Michael and Ruth Payne, who, unbeknownst to her, were working for the CIA. Lee was then in New Orleans being sheep-dipped, given a new persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer, handing out those Fair Play for Cuba committee flyers in the company of, among others, Rafael Cruz, the father of Ted Cruz. That was a shocking development when Trump called out that to be the case, but we long since confirmed it. Judith even met him on one occasion there in Dallas. He's also in a photograph on the cover of my first collection of scientific studies about the assassination, entitled Assassination Science, in the upper right-hand corner, standing beside Antonio Veciano, who is the founder of Alpha 66, a particularly vicious anti-Castro organization. There's Rafael Cruz in his glasses. We also know now that the figure who impersonated Lee Oswald in Mexico City...
I was going to ask you about that, because when you sent me your presentation, I looked at that. That's like slide number 30. And I was like, what? This guy looks like Al Bundy. You remember Al Bundy on, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. That's very funny. He does look like Al
Bundy. He looks just like that actor. I don't know what his real name is, but he'll always be Al Bundy to me. And I mean, how could anybody possibly mistake this guy for Lee Harvey Oswald? He's bald. He looks like Al Bundy. He looks nothing like Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, they didn't even give him a good double.
I know. That's absolutely right. In fact, he appears to be Walter Tobinski, who's been associated with a notorious crime family in Toronto, Canada. And he may have been there at the behest of Perm Index, which is this organization that is a Zionist outfit tied in with a major liquor distributor in Canada. But when they also have audio tapes, Maria, and it wasn't Lee's voice either. That's that J. Edgar Hoover was forced to send out a memorandum to his FBI section chief stating someone was in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald. I maintain that that's all you knew about the assassination. If the only thing you knew was that someone had been in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald, you'd realize that it had been a conspiracy and that Oswald had been framed. I mean, it's that devastating.
Right. Well, you know, even looking at the autopsy pictures of JFK, I have to tell you that they don't look like him at all.
Right.
I mean, not at all. It's like, okay, the only similarities I see are the age lines on the neck. The nose is different. The eyes are different. The ear certainly different. I would, I mean, I know that you lose a certain amount of your looks when you die because I've seen, you know, dead people.
Yeah.
And they almost look like a, I would say, a plastic replica of themselves.
Yeah.
But this is not that. Actually, his face, instead of looking more bloated like most people's faces get, it looks much more trimmed down, lean.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And it's just astonishing that until I asked Larry Rivera to do a superposition of, you know, the images you see in slide number 12.
Right.
And everyone can find all this for themselves by going to my blog and doing the search on that JFK, Bethesda autopsy photos, not JFK, and they can view it. And the GIFs, which are particularly striking, where you see the comparison between JFK and the body. Yes, it's clearly not JFK, and a fellow in New York by the name of Robert Morningstar has maintained for a very long time that it was Officer Tippit who bore a resemblance to JFK, which he's touted for decades, where Tippit, of course, was shot, as I described, you know, when Lee was already in the Texas theater buying popcorn. And you can find an affidavit from Butch Burroughs, who sold him the popcorn online, if you want to follow up. But it's not Tippit. We have photographs of Tippit, too, from Tippit's own autopsy, which was conducted by Earl Rose, a world-famous medical examiner in Dallas, which was like the homicide capital of the universe. It appears to be the body of someone that Dennis David, he was the Navy non-commissioned officer who was recording everyone who entered and left the morgue, had been instructed not to log in. A body that was described as that of a major. He was instructed not to log in. Now, if you think about it, when you have resources of, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops in the military, you're going to be able to find somebody who bears a pretty good resemblance to almost anyone you want.
Right.
And that appears to be the figure here, the major, not J.B. Tippit. You'll also see on the blog a comparison of the photograph of Tippit when he was undergoing his autopsy with a photograph of JFK where he has his eyes open and there's this large gaping opening in the throat, which is inconsistent with the observations from the physicians who performed the tracheostomy and observed it at the time. It was a small, clean puncture wound through which a straight line incision had been made by Malcolm Perry. But what happened in the course of the day, Maria, is that Bob Livingston, who was a world authority on the human brain and an expert on wound ballistics, heard the description of the small, clean puncture wound in the throat, knew it was a wound of entry. He was a scientific director of two of the National Institutes for Health, which are located across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital. So he called over to get in touch with Humes, who had conducted the autopsy, and explained to him that there was this puncture wound to the throat that was obviously a wound of entry, and therefore he needed to dissect the neck very carefully because, and this is so ironic in retrospect, if there were any evidence of shots from behind, then it would be obvious there were at least two shooters and therefore a conspiracy. They were cut off by the FBI, which Livingston thought was very strange. I mean, a discussion between physicians over the death of the President of the United States. Humes would call him back later and ask him what it would have looked like had it been a wound of exit, and Bob described it. Uh-huh. And Humes appears to have used Bob's description to change the wound and greatly expand it so that we have, you know, various outrages committed on the body. It may be the only body they altered was the major, however, because, I show you the photograph on the blog.
Right.
And it's clearly the same body in these others. So it may be. But we know that he actually took a cranial saw to the skull of John F. Kennedy and greatly enlarged the wound to the back of the head, which was fist size as it was observed in Parkland. So they could claim it was more like a wound that could have happened if JFK had been tilted way over and it entered the base of the back of his neck where a bullet actually did enter and exited the top of the head, which was false, and taken out this huge section. The two witnesses, including the mortician, actually observed him doing that. So when the ARRB came to depose him and they showed a diagram that had been made by Boswell, by Hume's assistant, J. Thornton Boswell, he said, oh, no, the doctors did that with a cranial saw, but you can find it described in the Bethesda autopsy report, which I included in Assassination Science as an appendix.
All right. Well, Jim, I got to tell you, this is like really interesting stuff, because my first thought was when I saw those pictures side by side, I honestly said to myself, I wonder who that poor bastard is on the left.
Yeah, I know.
I know, it's just terrible, but that's what I thought was my first thought. Jim, you have so many good updates on the invisible stories that disappeared, like Sandy Hook and Las Vegas. So I want to get to that when we come back from break. So stay with Jim and I. We'll be right back. It's the holiday season, a season of giving. Well, this holiday season, give a gift that lasts all year, the gift of knowledge. Consider gifting everyone you know a subscription to my show right here at maria.net. It's not just news. There's loads of spiritual, environmental knowledge, as well as tips on being as healthy as you can be. You may also consider giving yourself or someone else a private consultation with me. I love giving people the proper direction for their life based on their own blueprint prior to arriving here. Just send me an email with the name of the person receiving either the consult or subscription you paid for, and I'll set it all up with a note with who the gift is from. What better time than now to give the gift of knowledge? Sun Bear used to say taking in knowledge for the sake of taking in knowledge is a waste of time, and that knowledge only becomes wisdom when it's shared. Now, back to today's show. Welcome back to Roaring Truth with myself and Jim Fetza. Absolutely get over to his blog and check out all the pictures, especially, that we've been talking about. But Jim, you have so much stuff going on. I mean, one of the more exciting things, because I thought, you know, Sandy Hook would never hear from that again. And you published something on Wolfgang actually being successful after how many years since Sandy Hook?
Well, it's rather fascinating. What happened here is that a lawsuit that was brought by Lenny Posner, who claims to be the father of Noah, one of the kids alleged to have died at Sandy Hook, brought a lawsuit against Wolfgang for violating his privacy, publishing private information. I never thought the lawsuit had any merit at all because Lenny's a public figure. But Wolfgang has followed up, and because Lenny didn't show for the first three pre-trial hearings, Wolfgang got the right to discovery, and he has a new attorney, very competent, a new judge on the case who isn't going to horse around, and directed that Lenny be subjected to a video deposition. At the last minute, Lenny withdrew his lawsuit. He didn't want to go through it. He didn't want to expose. I'm convinced he's working for the government. I mean, that's the only thing that makes any sense. He's persistently sought to take down websites that deal with Sandy Hook. His alleged son, Noah, is a very curious little boy because he not only is reported to have died in Newtown on 14 December 2012, but again in Pakistan on 16 December 2014, 2 years later, when Kelly Watt, who's a very astute student of Sandy Hook, had over 100 conversations with Lenny. She told him she didn't believe a word he said. She didn't believe he had a son, didn't believe he died, asked for proof. Lenny undoubtedly, inadvisedly, sent her a death certificate that was a fabrication, the bottom half of a real death certificate, the top half of a fake, had no file number, had the wrong estimated time of death at 11 a.m. when the shooting took place. No actual shooting took place, but purportedly between 9:30 and 9:35. Obviously, if he had had a son who'd actually died, he would have been able to provide a real death certificate, not a fake one. It turns out, of course, that those who have followed the case know there was no surge of EMTs into the building on the morning of the 14th, no string of ambulances to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they could be determined to be dead or alive. No medevac helicopter was called. No bodies were put on the triage tarps that were laid out in the parking lot. And it turns out they were only identified using photographs, which was particularly appropriate because they only existed as photographs. We've been able to determine that they faked the kids out of photographs of older children when they were younger, Maria. If you go to my blog, Sandy Hook charade. Noah Posner was Michael Zabner as a child. You discover that Kelly Watt was right when she noticed the striking similarity in the appearance between the young Noah and his older stepbrother, Michael Zabner. We got a half a dozen of us working on it, including Larry doing overlays. Mm-hmm. And we were able to establish that, in fact, Noah Posner was made up out of photographs of Michael Zabner as a child. This also accounts for the 10-year discrepancy in the average age of the Sandy Hook mothers. They were roughly going back 10 years in time. They averaged 36, which is rather than 26 across the nation for first births. And that turns out to be staggeringly improbable that you'd have the 20 Sandy Hook parents averaging 10 years of age older.
Well, you know, you have all that information and the most outstanding pictures in your book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. But I think the big update, you know, on this was that lawsuit was dropped. And where did you ever see anybody mention that? Do you know what I mean? They always put you on the front page when they're trying to take you down. But when they lose, it's like no news at all. Now, I don't mean to rush you, but I want to,
Let me just add that. What did you hear on the mainstream media about JFK? They virtually went silent.
Very little. Although I did get some good stuff off, you know, the alternative media that I've been following for 20 years. But I wanted to see what were the big Lollapaloozas, the big revelations. The big revelations is pretty much was just agreeing that we were right all along. But there's so many, you have so many stories here. I mean, from the 9/11 airlines paying out to Boston bombers. Okay, we got to try to touch on all of them. We got 15 minutes.
You got it.
Paul Craig Roberts' article on the 13th, Federal Appeals Court agrees to hear the case for Sarnieff's innocence.
Well, John Remington Graham is a retired professor of law I've been in contact and collaborated with for some time. He has contributions to the book, and Nobody Died in Boston Either, for example. I asked him when we reviewed all the evidence what was most striking to him, and it was that the backpacks don't match. The FBI had concluded in their investigation of the Boston bombing that the two bombs that exploded were in black nylon backpacks. Well, when they photoshopped the brothers into the scene, and it was done by photographing, photoshopping, they weren't there. But they made a glitch. They blundered because they put the Zoker with a silver backpack and Tamerlan, his older brother, with a gray or beige backpack. In other words, they don't match. They aren't black nylon. So Jack told me the fact that they didn't even match, the backpacks didn't match, meant there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction at trial, which, of course, is precisely what happened. So he was very troubled by this and has put together an amicus curiae brief on behalf of the family and the accused bomber, since he's clearly innocent, which he had to submit to the First Circuit Court of Appeal. And remarkably enough, they've accepted his amicus curiae brief. It's already now part of the official record, so it's going to blow apart the Boston bombing. This is stunning stuff.
I think this is huge. And I want to just mention, you know, one of the lines in here. It says, that means that he and others will be permitted to make, before the appeals court, the case for Dokar's innocence, a case not made by his appointed attorney at the trial.
Obviously
the attorney wasn't working for him if he didn't even bother to say this kid is innocent.
Her name is Judy Clark, and although she pled him not guilty, in her opening statement she said they did it, which of course was false. It was rubbish. I mean, we had the police on bullhorns calling out, this is a drill, this is a drill. We had the Boston Globe tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. In a second tweet, one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library. Mm. And 1 minute later, in front of the Boston Public Library, one of these puff bombs go off. I'm a former artillery officer in the Marine Corps, Maria, and I'm telling you, those bombs weren't powerful enough to kill anyone unless perhaps you were actually sitting right on top of them. And it's, the whole thing's ludicrous. When you peer in through the smoke, you see bodies missing arms and legs, but there is no blood. They used amputee actors. The blood only showed up later. It came out of tubes. It was Hollywood blood. I mean, it was a disgrace. In fact, a Hollywood producer director suggested to me that they'd actually used a smoke machine, and we poured through the videos and photos and found it. I was so stunned, I put it on the back cover of the book. A studio quality smoke machine. The whole thing was a total fabrication.
Yeah, I remember the photographs. I think even Dave McGowan had that picture in his body of work on it. All right, let's jump around some more. Here's another huge story nobody's talking about. Airlines agree to a $95.2 million payout over the hijacked planes used on 9/11 16 years later. What do you make of this, Jim?
Well, it's completely absurd, Maria, because no planes hit the buildings. We've been able to prove that. This was a part of a huge lawsuit that was brought by Silverstein Properties. They were after $12.3 billion. He's not going to miss a trick to collect an extra nickel. He had fired the security firm that was looking after the World Trade Center since it first opened in 1970. Replaced it with Kroll, an Israeli security firm. This is taking possession of the World Trade Center just 6 weeks before the event, the attacks of the 9/11. He actually changed the insurance policy to have an anti-terrorist clause so that being able to claim two planes, two attacks, double indemnity. He pocketed over $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. Here he's going after 12.3 more. They settled for $95.2 million. But, you know, the airlines knew their planes weren't involved. In fact, two of those flights weren't even in the air, Flight 11, North Tower, and 77, Pentagon. The Bureau of Transportation Statistics records, which record all takeoff and landing of commercial flights in the United States, did not even have them scheduled that day. It was an oversight on the part of the plotters.
Right, and then they didn't bother to decommission them for how long after 9/11?
That's right. For the other two, which were discovered by pilots for 9/11 Truth to have been in the air, Flight 93, for example, over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, after it had purportedly crashed in Shanksville, 175 over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it allegedly hit the South Tower, where, as you correctly observe, I obtained FAA registration records and discovered that the planes that had been used for those two flights, where of course the same plane can be used for many different flights, were not formally taken out of service or deregistered until 28 September 2005. So how can planes that weren't in the air have crashed on 9/11? How can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? How can suicide hijackers have turned up alive and well the following day and made contact with the British media? I mean, it's all outrageous.
Right.
It proves the whole thing was an elaborate scam and that the war on terror was predicated on a false proposition. We've been lied to again and again and again.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you think about, I'm sure you remember Flight 800, right?
Yeah.
After that was shot down over Long Island, I believe it was. They managed to reconstruct that in a hangar. Okay, where are the reconstructed planes 16 years later from 9/11?
Right. That's a very nice point. And of course, TWA-800 was shot down by a missile fired from a submarine at Long Island Sound. I mean, there were hundreds of witnesses who saw the missile come up from the water and hit the plane.
Right.
So that, you know, they had the crew of the sub sworn to silence. I mean, this is what they do, you know. They put pressure on people who want to speak the truth. In Sandy Hook, you had the police lieutenant, Paul Vance, threatened to prosecute anyone who gave a story at variance with the official police account. The police were running the op in Sandy Hook, Maria. It's embarrassing. We have 15 photographs of them furnishing an empty house to be the Adam Lanza residence. But it's very clear this was a home that had not been lived in. There is nothing on the walls. There are no drawings, paintings, photographs, nothing on the walls. No personal items on dressers or anywhere in the house. We also have 50 photographs. And these photographs, by the way, were all taken by the Connecticut State Police of a SWAT vehicle already there prematurely the night before. Above the top, you can see a string of four windows in Classroom 10 that are undamaged. You go down the flagpole at full mast, and there's a familiar figure, Wayne Carver, leaning against the wall with his arms folded, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. There's crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. We also have photos of before and after of the windows in classroom 10. We have the perps drilling holes in the aluminum window frame to simulate bullet holes. We have pink rods extending from those holes they drilled that are supposed to be taken as, trajectories of bullets, but it's a fantasy. They're exactly 90 degrees to the window panes. They're all parallel to one another. No one familiar with marksmanship would be taken, and it was this level of absurdity to which they have subjected the American people. And anyone, by the way, Maria, can download the book for free. It was banned by Amazon.com less than a month after I put it on sale. So I release it for free as a PDF. Just put in the title, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and you can download it and confirm for yourself. We even include the FEMA manual for the two-day exercise as Appendix A.
All right. I remember seeing that in the book. I was like, what? Okay, so we have about 7 minutes. Let's go over to Las Vegas, the biggest shooting supposedly in the history of the world. And that story became a non-story as fast as it became a story.
I think once it too was blown apart because it was a movie. They had a pre-recorded soundtrack they played over the PA system of actual machine guns firing, actual bullets hitting hard surfaces, coordinated with special visual effects of flashing lights in the Mandalay Bay in the center of the hotel on the fourth floor, and then several floors above it, three light blasts to simulate American weapons. We've gone through 33 videos. You hear lots of sounds of shots. You don't see anyone being hit by any real rounds. The three closest hospitals were contacted by a friend on Facebook, and all three confirmed they'd received no gunshot victims when there were supposed to be over 500 who were wounded. They would have been swamped.
What do you think about the fact that there were reported shootings at other hotels? They even found shells outside, I think. I don't remember the name of the other hotel, but I know that the Italian hotel, the Biagio, supposedly they had a response team there. They found shells in another hotel's parking lot.
Right.
How come all those stories went away?
Well, they also had simulated attacks at the Bellagio, the Flamingo, New York. We even have the transcript of the police scanner for this fake mass casualty drill. It was another drill. In fact, we have an American military surgeon with vast experience with gunshot victims certifying, based on his review of videos of patients in hospitals, that they're all actors. None of them has actually suffered a bona fide wound. We have an American trauma surgeon confirming that they're not even connected to the diagnostic equipment to monitor their blood pressure or their IV drops. We have a woman, very talented, Mona Alexis Presley, who's been going through the obituaries, and she's discovered one after another is for a person who died in a different state or on a different date or from a different cause of death. But we have a video from Hooters where Intel Hub was playing. They thought because there were 17 ambulances outside of Hooters that there'd been a mass shooting in Hooters. But from the inside footage, you see there are crisis actors sitting around with sheets waiting to be taken out on stretchers as victims. I mean, they're all perfectly alive and well. I mean, you couldn't have more proof that this was a fraud, a total, complete deception. If you wanted, and look here, the latest report, the sheriff who's been muzzled saying Stephen Paddock fired over 1,100 rounds at the Las Vegas concert, but when we look at the photographs from inside his suite, there aren't 1,100 shell casings. In fact, in relation to the dead body, you see shell casings on top of the blood. Presumably, when he kills himself, when he's dead, he's no longer firing any rounds. The shell casing ought to have been under the blood. They're on top of the blood. Scott Bennett.
All right. They look like they were just sprinkled there like confetti.
They were, Maria, that's exactly right. This was some prop assistant, just sprinkled them around because when they make movies, they know they can get away with it. It's just the impression. But some of these turn out to be shell casings from blanks. Some turn out to be shell casings from CO2 cartridges that you use to fire gas-propelled pellet guns. It's totally fraudulent. The handgun is in the wrong position. If he shot himself, it wouldn't be well above his head. So we know this is all complete and utter nonsense. We have a security guard who actually works at the Mandalay Bay on the 32nd floor doesn't know, has never seen Jesus Campos, who would disappear. He's not recorded as a security guard in the registry for security guards in Las Vegas. He would appear on the Ellen DeGeneres show, but he's now like 30 to 50 pounds heavier, doesn't wear his prescription glasses. Ellen doesn't seem to be enthusiastic about interviewing him. It's apparent this was obligatory because her show is owned by MGM, which owns the Mandalay Bay, whose chief executive officer sold off 80% of his stock in the company before the shooting in order to buy it back up cheap and make a bundle. In the meanwhile, George Soros placed a $41 million short on the Mandalay Bay and MGM to make a bundle when the stock dropped. We even have a 15 days in advance a report, you know, of crowds on demand, the Los Angeles area PR firm recruiting. So what they did was to salt the concert crowd. So when on cue, they heard the audio special effects being played over the sound system and the visual, they started reacting as though there were real bullets really being fired. But we have other photographs of them behind the automobiles laughing about it.
Well, what do you make then? But what do you make then of all these witnesses? That young girl who said there were multiple shooters on the ground. They found her dead in her bed like the next day. She was 28. They said it was she died in normal circumstances. This other witness just this week, who was killed in a hit and run. What do you think about all these witnesses taken out? And, you know, some of the witnesses that said that there were police helicopters firing down upon them from the airport, from McCarran Airport.
They're dumping everything but the kitchen sink in here. You even have, you know, the sheik is supposed to have had his people, his snipers, turned on the crowd.
Right.
Nobody died there. It was all completely fraudulent. We even have a latest revelation. You can find it on YouTube. Footage emerges of Vegas crisis director caught directing scene at Vegas shooting. They did a redo. They did two takes of this particular scene, and the director tells the actors how to redo it. Obviously, totally fraudulent. Now, we do have footage where there appears to be a shooter in the crowd, and you can see the light flashes, but he's firing blanks. So I think it was a problem they had. If they're claiming they had only one shooter on the 32nd floor, witnesses who report more than one shooter are an inconvenience and may have therefore been eliminated. They might be crisis actors who've had a change in conscience and want to come clean about it. They'd want to eliminate them too.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I don't know if you saw it. You remember that shooting that happened at that black church a couple of weeks ago? I can't keep them apart.
It was a white church, if you mean down in Texas, actually.
Right. I told you, I can't keep them apart. But one of the women that was in the church said the firing was coming from the roof, from the ceiling.
Right. She got off the script. That was all completely fraudulent, completely fake. This is a little church in a community of 400 that you wouldn't even notice if you were driving on the highway. And yet they were doing a high-definition video broadcast of their services, which were very strange. It looked like a rock band out there. You got one guy with a double-neck guitar, another with a regular guitar, a woman singing. They got a Harley Davidson up there with a flower arrangement in lieu of an altar. The whole thing was totally fraudulent. I watched the service the week before. It was an hour long, very strange, but nothing unusual. The second service for the day of the event was only 20 minutes long, and nothing happens while you're watching the service. I think they cut it early because they had to blam for the staged event. But
I know it's unfair because we got like 30 seconds, but with all these different shootings, false flags, stage events, whatever you want to call them, what do you think? Obviously, they must all have the same goal. So what is the goal?
Well, the goal is to instill fear in the people, to have more dependence on the police, a greater degree of militarization, you know, the strengthening police forces and the grip of the government on the people. My belief is that Donald Trump is opposed to this, and I've therefore been disturbed that we're seeing any of these happening at all. But there are rogue groups that are working here. And, of course, George Soros and James Madden, the CEO of Mandalay Bay, stood to gain a bundle. Michael Cherkov is in the offing wanting to put his scanners into all the resorts and casinos in New York and eventually all the churches and the schools around the country to make hundreds of billions. I mean, it's outrage. Those scanners are subjecting you to 30 seconds of radiation exposure. Remember, when you go to a dentist, they cover you with a lead vest before they expose your teeth for milliseconds. I mean, it's all completely outrageous and disgusting to promote personal and public agendas.
I totally agree. Well, calm yourself down, Jim. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
And I'll talk again soon. Take care.
You got it, Maria. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Jim Fetzer, he gets all excited. I do too sometimes, but like I always say, just because it's a staged event or a false flag doesn't mean they actually didn't kill any people. So on that, we're going to all continue to keep doing the research, but I can tell you every story lately just stinks to high heaven. Anyway, that's today's show. I will be back on Thursday with the news. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.